Today we're going to discuss a crime so terrible, so unthinkable, that even the most famous crime writers and filmmakers wouldn't be able to come up with such a storyline. A story of extreme violence and unimaginable theft. Welcome to the Beyond Evil podcast, where we discuss and dissect the most mysterious, terrifying, and mind-bending cases from all over the world. Before we start, we would like to send our sincere condolences to the loved ones of Regan Simmons Hancock, whose life was brought to a premature end by a sick, evil person and their actions. On this channel, we investigate chilling, mysterious, and often thought-provoking crimes that have shaken communities to their very cores, and this case is certainly no exception. Crimes are committed by people for many reasons. Love, fear, hate, jealousy, money. We will let you decide which category this tragic case falls under. The tragic victim of this horrific crime was just 21 years old. Her name, Regan Michelle Simmons Hancock. She was born on November 14, 1998, in Hope, Arkansas. Well-liked within her community and a devout churchgoer, she was described by friends and family as someone who was a joy to all who knew her, and a woman who had a beautiful soul. She and her husband, Homer Hancock, lived in New Boston, Texas, with their three-year-old daughter, Kinley. For Regan and her husband, life was good. She worked as a customer service representative at Flying Burger, but everyone who knew her saw where her heart truly belonged, and it wasn't customer service. Her biggest joy in life was that of being the best mother and wife that she could. Life had been made even better with the news that the couple were expecting their second child. They were so excited by the news that they actually had already named their new daughter Braxlyn Sage. Tragically, on the 9th of October 2020, lives would be changed in such a devastating way for the family that one can hardly imagine how they could ever really return to any kind of normality ever again. At 10:18 a.m., police dispatch received a frantic 911 call from a screaming, extremely distraught woman. She had found a 21-year-old mother who had been in the prime of her life, 34 weeks pregnant with her second child, lying motionless, having bled to death. She had been hit in the head repeatedly, slashed with a blade, and her abdomen crudely sliced open from hip to hip. "Someone has killed my baby," the woman screamed down the phone. When police arrived at the scene, they discovered 21-year-old Regan Hancock's lifeless body, which had tragically failed to cling on to just enough life for emergency services. They just didn't have time to come to her aid. Regan had clearly put up a brave fight in a bid to save her life. The scene of murder was awash with blood. It was all over the walls, floors, appliances, furniture, and, of course, around the body itself. Her hands had multiple stab wounds and scrapes and were covered in blood, with one finger just barely hanging on, presumably as Regan had tried to defend herself from this savage attack. The emergency call had been made by Regan's mother, Jessica Brooks. She frantically screamed to the officers that Regan was 34 weeks pregnant and had to check if the baby was okay. However, disturbingly, when the officers rolled the poor deceased mother's body over, they discovered a huge gash across her stomach and, astonishingly, no baby. Both Regan's mother and the emergency services could not believe what they were seeing. Regan Hancock was no longer pregnant. All of this had happened to Regan while her three-year-old daughter was in the next room. Jessica sent Regan's father to check on their granddaughter. Thankfully, she was unharmed. The first thing she said to her grandfather was, "Where's Mommy?" Further across town, on the same day, just a half hour before Jessica Brooks discovered the murdered body of her daughter, police would receive another 911 call from a 27-year-old woman who reported that she was being followed by state troopers. Police had given pursuit of the woman for driving erratically with her hazard lights on. She had almost crashed into a pickup truck and then a cyclist. She gave the dispatcher the reason for bad driving, informing her that she was having a baby and needed to get to a hospital as soon as possible. The police dispatcher advised her to comply with the pursuing law enforcement officers so they could offer their professional assistance. In a distressed tone, she told the dispatcher over the phone that she had to get to Idabel, Oklahoma, because that was where her doctor was based. Eventually, the lady does come to her senses and pulls over. When police approach the 2009 Toyota Corolla, they discover an unusual scene. A lady was sitting with a baby on her lap, wrapped in a blood-soaked blanket, her umbilical cord still attached to the child and going into the woman's pants. The woman immediately explains to the officer that she had just given birth on the side of the road and her baby wasn't breathing, and that she needed the officer to get them in his car quickly. The lady hadn't hung up the phone yet, so the whole conversation was recorded by the dispatcher as well as on the state trooper's body cam. The officer, of course, put the mother and baby's safety first. The car was not a pretty sight. The woman was covered in blood from head to toe. There was blood on the inside of her car, but strangely, none on the driver's seat, noted the state trooper. By a stroke of luck, an off-duty nurse was passing the scene and saw what was happening. She stopped and got out of her car and offered her assistance. The woman tells the state trooper that she has been due to give birth on September 30th. Now remember, this was all taking place on October 9th. Both the nurse and the state trooper recalled how her comments on her due date gave them immediate cause for concern. They noted that the woman looked very petite for someone who would be in a late stage of her pregnancy, and when they were informed of the due date, that should have been a couple of weeks earlier, they were shocked. The baby was so overdue, but it was very small. They tried to convince the woman that for her safety and the life of her newborn baby, they must go to the nearest hospital, but she adamantly refuses. She does, however, allow the nurse to inspect her. They remove her pants with trauma shears, and the placenta falls on the floor in front of them. The baby is not breathing. This is an urgent situation. Emergency services, who serve day in and day out, all have the same primary responsibility, the preservation of life. They agree to the woman's demands and set off for Idabel, Oklahoma. In the back seat of the trooper's car, the nurse gives CPR to the poor child that's fighting to cling on to its very short-lived life. The woman was naturally distraught next to her. Both the nurse and the state trooper could hear her say, "Come on, Clancy." When they arrive at the hospital in Idabel, the baby, which is barely alive at this point, was put into intensive care. The medical staff now have the duty to care for what they believe to be the mother. She refuses to be examined or helped in any way. This is a woman who has just given birth in a car at the roadside. Her child may die. Any woman, of course, would be in shock, distraught at their situation, and the last thing they would want would be a medical examination at that time. The woman's name is Taylor Parker. On the face of it, a woman who has gone through not one, but two of the most traumatic experiences a woman can go through: giving birth, and then facing the possibility of that child dying. For any woman who goes through either of these experiences, aftercare, of course, is essential. So why wouldn't Taylor agree to any kind of medical treatment? Because all was not as it seemed. As staff did what they could do to examine Taylor, they made a disturbing discovery. The umbilical cord had clearly been attached to the poor child, but to the surprise of the medical staff, it hadn't been attached to Taylor Parker, who was sitting in front of them claiming to have just given birth. Medical staff were left confused, suspicious, and uncertain of the right course of action. But anyone could see that something was very wrong with the situation, and they called the police. But who is Taylor Parker, and how does she fit in with the murder of Reagan Michelle Simmons Hancock? Taylor Parker has two children of her own, both with different fathers. She had married the fathers of her sons, but neither marriage lasted long, both being described as toxic roller coaster relationships. As a result, she was a woman with little stability in her life and is desperate for a partner to complete her family. Despite having been divorced twice, her appetite for a life partner didn't go away. Just weeks after her second divorce, she met Wade Griffin at a rodeo. Their relationship progressed at a rapid pace. Within a few weeks, she told Wade that she had become pregnant with his child, but had unfortunately suffered a miscarriage. At this stage, what most couples may call the honeymoon period, their relationship was good. Wade was genuinely sympathetic to the miscarriage of his child, and the loss strengthened their bond, bringing them closer together. However, it didn't take long for Wade to start having some mixed feelings. She told Wade that she was due to inherit a large amount of money, millions of dollars, in fact, in oil and gas royalties. She went on to tell him the other details of her dysfunctional family life. She said that her mother, Shona, had actually taken out a contract on her life, and she was naturally frightened. Wade was a good guy. He offered to let her move into his place to provide her with some safety and protection, but the story escalated rapidly when Taylor told Wade that her mother was hacking into their cell phones to find out where they were, and even worse, the Mexican mafia was now involved. Was this all true? Or an elaborate tale concocted by a vivid imagination? Wade worked for a hog company. They transported and sold hogs in various places. He owned his own vehicle, and although he wasn't what you would consider wealthy, he was happy and made a decent living. With the promise from Taylor that millions of dollars were going to flow into their bank account very soon, Taylor convinced Wade to buy some new equipment. Wade went out and bought a side-by-side, a truck, and even some cattle. He didn't, however, buy these items outright. He took out loans on them, again, with the promise from Taylor that she would give him the money back from her inheritance. Taylor had, at first, been popular with Wade's family. She made a good impression on them, and they believed her to be a sweet woman. However, this didn't last very long. The family grew suspicious of the stories that she told of her alleged inheritance, and most of all, they grew suspicious as to why she did not have custody to her two sons. In most cases, in many countries, a court will side with the mother over the father in regards to custody, but not in her case. As time went on, the inheritance did not materialize. Taylor said that she was having trouble getting hold of the money. The Griffin family also noticed Wade growing less fond of Taylor. She was always the one pushing him to do things, but he was far more cautious when it came to relationships and wanted to take things more slowly. Nevertheless, he clearly had strong feelings for her because the relationship did continue, despite Wade's family's misgivings. Taylor approached Wade regarding a property called Pecan Point, right over the Oklahoma border, a stunning remote property surrounded by luscious green tall trees and dark green grass, acre after acre of wildflower meadows as far as the eye could see, a river running around the perimeter almost like a medieval castle surrounded by a natural moat, a marshland, a lake, and fertile farmland. Wade was a keen hunter, and when presented with the property, his eyes lit up. Let's be honest, if you yourself were given the opportunity to move to that kind of property, would you turn it down? Not many of us would. The property was advertised at $4.7 million. Given her inheritance that was apparently coming soon, Taylor approached the agent about buying the property, telling him that she was an heiress to the Blackburn Syrup fortune. Wait a minute. Her inheritance was coming from gas and oil royalties, wasn't it? Well, apparently not. The story had changed. Alarm bells would have started ringing had Wade and the agent spoken to each other, but of course, they hadn't. Taylor was the go-between, and she put in an offer on the property of $3.5 million, which was accepted by the agent. Taylor was required to put down a goodwill deposit of $200,000 to secure the property. That Christmas, Wade and Taylor presented his family with Christmas cards that had pictures of Pecan Point on them. Jubilant and celebratory, the family were told that they would never have to worry about finding a hunting lease ever again. Perhaps, in a shallow way, Wade's family seemed to have cast aside their misgivings about Taylor, and they were very happy indeed. To compound their joy, the couple also announced that Taylor was pregnant. Life seemed perfect for all concerned. However, as it seems to be a theme with this woman, once again, things were not as they seemed. The time came to sign and exchange the contract on the property. Instead of signing her name Taylor Parker, as you would expect, she signed her name Taylor Parker Griffin. In the modern world, it isn't uncommon for a woman not wanting to give up her family surname, and so they often hyphenate their surname with that of their partner. But we must remember one vital detail. Wade and Taylor were not married. Property documents are serious, legally binding contracts. To present fake information on them is a criminal offense, and that was exactly what she had done. You may think this sounds like an odd scenario when purchasing a property, but Trust me, it's about to get worse. Taylor Parker, or Taylor Parker Griffin, as she was strangely calling herself now, still hadn't actually paid for the property yet. The $7 million transfer she said she had been promised from Blackburn Syrup didn't materialize. She strangely then said that it wasn't a problem. She would use the money from her oil and gas royalties instead. You'll notice that the two stories regarding her inheritance have now become entangled with each other. As well as Pecan Point, Taylor also had her eyes on two other properties. In total, these came to a combined value of over $20 million. But she hadn't purchased the first property she was looking at. The agent was now getting understandably worried about the sale. When he contacted Taylor, she told him that it wasn't a problem. She had an uncle, Butch, who had the money and was going to pay for the property. Luckily for him, the agent wasn't a fool. He knew something wasn't quite right. What really confirmed his suspicions were several calls he received from Wade asking why he was holding up the sale. Clearly, Wade wasn't being kept in the loop at all. He didn't even know that the millions of dollars that were supposedly being wired to Taylor hadn't come through. Some of you may be wondering, how did she pay the $200,000 deposit on the property in the first place? The answer, as you may guess, is she didn't. She did, in fact, write a check, but strangely and almost immediately asked for it back. To the agent's surprise, Taylor did, in fact, go to see him and presented him with gas and oil royalty certificates. It seemed that she had been telling the truth after all. As we pointed out before, this is not the agent's first rodeo. He was experienced and was not going to take these certificates at face value. He sent them off to a landman in Texas for verification. And guess what? He quickly and confidently sent them back to the agent stating the certificates were, in fact, forgeries. The agent now began to question everything he had been told by this woman. To hold the property, he had been given documents, allegedly from a company called Shell Western Global. These documents did confirm that Taylor Parker was due to receive wire transfers totaling $370 million. Having looked closer at these documents, something he should surely have done at a much earlier stage in the proceedings, he noticed they had not been sent from a company, they had been sent from an AOL email address under the name of Shelley Links. Shell Western Global is a real company, a huge company, most importantly, a professional company. Why on earth would they be using an AOL email address instead of a company email address? Of course, they wouldn't. The agent tried to contact Shelley Links and Taylor's apparently rich uncle, Butch. This did not go down well with Taylor. She emailed the agent saying that she had spoken to an attorney who had dealt with far more valuable land deals than this and that he had no right to check up on her or her family's wealth. She also stated that her uncle Butch was a multimillionaire landowner and had refused the agent's request. He did, however, get a reply from the AOL email address of Shelley Links. Miss Link stated that all banking information was confidential. Neither Wade nor Taylor had been made aware that any form of verification of funds was necessary before the contracts were signed. Let's remember now, we are not dealing with an ordinary property here. This isn't a three-bed detached garage worth a couple of hundred thousand dollars. This is acres of prime real estate with an agreed selling price of $3.5 million. In what world wouldn't an agent want some verification to make sure these buyers could afford a property of this size and value? Strangely, and perhaps a little naively, the message from Shelley Links actually gave the agent a little comfort that the deal was moving forward. But the agent was about to get a big dose of reality. In April of 2020, Taylor contacted the agent and told him the whole deal was off. The agent stood to make about $1.15 million in commission on this deal, and he wanted a reason. Taylor told him that her mom, Shona, who you will recall apparently had taken a contract out on her life, had made everything up. There was no such person as Uncle Butch. There were no gas and oil royalties. There wasn't money coming from the Blackburn Syrup fortune. She said her mother had been lying about everything. You will recall that on Christmas of 2019, just a few months before the land deal fell through, Taylor had totally redeemed herself in the eyes of the Wade family. She was pregnant with their grandchild, and something we didn't mention earlier, she had bought Wade's mom her dream car that she had lusted after for so long, a gray Nissan Altima Platinum. Now the family's golden girl, they believed her. The car arrived as promised, but not for long. Just a few short weeks later, Taylor told Wade's mom that the dealership had contacted her, stating that the vehicle was on recall from the manufacturer and that she would need to drop it off at Wade's property. Although not happy, and now suspicious of Taylor again, they did in fact drop the car off. As Wade's mom left their home, she told her husband, "We will never see that car again." Her husband said that you couldn't know that for certain. But Wade's mom was adamant that this would be the last time she would ever drive her dream car. And she was right. A few weeks went by and they heard nothing from the dealership. Wade's parents decided to call and find out what was going on. The dealership told them that there was no recall on the vehicle, and there never had been. The only thing that came close to a recall regarding the vehicle was the dealership calling Taylor to ask her to return it because it hadn't been paid for. What made the situation even worse is that Taylor had been constantly promising Wade's father a new barn to replace one that had burned down in a fire. Yes, you guessed it. The barn never materialized either. Taylor's web of deceit was starting to unravel. However, whatever she had said or had promised, she was still the mother-to-be of their unborn grandchild. Enter Angela Pate. She was a relative of Wade by marriage. She and Taylor had grown up close over time, and Taylor had often complained about her relationship issues with Wade to her. Not the sort of issues every relationship has, but fear and paranoia that Wade would one day leave her. Angela, although a confidant of Taylor, was growing more suspicious. Perhaps the biggest red flag here is that Taylor had once told Angela that she had had a hysterectomy some years before. Angela had insisted, like any right-minded person would, of course, that Taylor take another pregnancy test. Let's be real here. No woman who has had a hysterectomy could possibly be pregnant. Taylor refused, telling Angela that she was certain she was pregnant and that the pregnancy had been intended by God. In March of 2020, ignoring Angela's advice completely, Taylor announced to the world on social media that she was pregnant. She didn't hold back her joy and happiness one bit. She shared scan photos with the family and again on social media, even going so far as to share the urine test result over the internet. In an effort to reassure Angela, Taylor sent her a letter from the hospital confirming that she was, in fact, pregnant. Angela read the letter, and at first it seemed genuine. However, one rather large issue with the letter popped up that she noticed. The letter had been signed by a nurse confirming the pregnancy, but that nurse had the same name as the patient on the letter who was pregnant. That name wasn't Taylor Parker. Angela told Taylor about the issue and that this letter did not confirm she was pregnant. Taylor became very defensive, bordering on aggressive toward Angela. Taylor said that her mother had a mole in the clinic who must have doctored the letter out of spite. Angela wasn't buying any of it, but knew that she had to be smart. A big row wouldn't help the situation. Angela conceded, to Taylor's face at least, that a mole in the clinic must have interfered with the document. Unfortunately for Taylor, Angela had a good memory. She recalled a conversation in which Taylor had told her once that her mother had committed suicide some years ago. Apparently, her family weren't aware that the mother had killed herself and didn't bat an eye when she appeared at a Christmas party a little while back. Naturally, Angela was extremely surprised to see the apparently dead Shona turn up for a drink and the buffet. By now, you're probably wondering how many lies can one person come up with? How can she remember them all? How does she still have a family, friends, and a partner? Well, she isn't done yet. In April of 2020, Angela received an email from someone called Mandy. The email stated that Mandy was, in fact, Taylor's mother. The email was quite sinister in its content. Mandy said, "Do not try to be a mother figure for Taylor. You know nothing about her." It got more intriguing than that, with Mandy saying that she had done an amazing job of making Taylor look bad to the world. Quoting now, "I have carefully planned this every step of the way, right down to the check that Taylor went to pay the bank, believing it to be family money from her rich uncle. Let her fall in life. Let her see what it's like to have nothing." End quote. Mandy claimed that everything she planned out was to make Taylor look like a liar, but that Taylor believed it to be true. Angela was naturally concerned. This Mandy person, if she was Taylor's mother, was trying to send her own daughter into a spiral of depression that might lead to her taking her own life. She later went on to claim that she was responsible for Wade's family turning on her, and that it was only a matter of time before Wade left her. She even claimed to have been behind the dealership saying that they hadn't paid for the Nissan Altima. In what was probably the most disgusting statement in the email, she stated that Taylor, when she was a child, should have been terminated. She was an accident she didn't want. Now, before you let your emotion cloud your judgment too much, let's take a step back. This email was in-depth, detailed, and in many ways seemed to try and seek some justification for the actions of Taylor Parker. For that reason alone, Angela doubts the validity of the email and is still unsure about the pregnancy. She went out and bought a number of different pregnancy tests, and all of them came back negative, except for one that was questionable. Angela insisted that Taylor accompany her to a clinic to get definitive proof once and for all. Taylor agreed. This, of course, was during the pandemic, so Angela could not go into the clinic with her. After a short time, Taylor appeared outside with what Angela described as a strange look on her face and a piece of paper. Taylor had gone into the clinic with nothing but a purse. The paper also had not been folded and stated that Taylor was pregnant. Angela now believed her. This was a freshly printed document that hadn't been folded. There was no justification for doubting Taylor any longer. Angela may have been convinced, but Wade's mom was not, and this led to growing tensions between her and her son. She and Wade had gotten into blazing rows over the validity of the pregnancy, and before their relationship had hit a breaking point, Wade's mom backed off so she didn't lose her son for good. A week later, she even attended the gender reveal party the company had held, in which they announced they were having a baby girl. With their relationship still intact, Wade approached his mom for a private conversation. He said that he had received an email from someone called Mandy. The email gave details of the couple's movements, their habits, and even their stated specific times that they had sat together outside of their home on a swing. Wade thought the email from Mandy was genuine, and naturally he was concerned. He was paranoid to the point where he believed that Taylor's mom had set up cameras looking into their backyard to spy on them. Wade's mom wasn't buying any of it. She was aware of the email Angela had received from this Mandy character and was 100% of the opinion that Taylor was in fact Mandy. She said loudly and for everyone to hear, "Whoever wrote these emails is pure evil." Taylor was sitting opposite them, but a little distance away, so she couldn't hear the conversation which led up to that. As Wade's mom made her loud remarks, she stared glaringly in Taylor's direction, leaving everyone in no doubt who she thought was behind these sick emails. You may think that having such a charge laid at her feet, Taylor would be spooked, but no, she continued to smile and celebrate as if nothing had happened. As the weeks passed, she remained active on social media, sharing her life day in and day out, making sure that everyone knew she was pregnant and so happy about it. She even went to register at the hospital for her due date, although there was an error. She put down 28 September instead of 22. It, of course, could be a mistake made by the hospital, given how organized and excited Taylor was. Surely she couldn't have made a mistake like that herself. Keeping up her social media posting, on July the 2nd, she posted a strange message reading that prayers were needed for Clancy Gale, which is what they had decided to name their daughter. The message continued saying lots of appointments and scans. However, these issues seemed to pass, as in August, she and Wade had maternity pictures taken together, Taylor and Wade, both with their hands on her belly. Despite registering at the hospital, buying baby clothes, and even the obvious baby bump that Taylor had, people were still not convinced. The relationship between Taylor and Wade wasn't as it had been either. By August, even though they had taken the photos together, Wade had apparently already told Taylor that he wasn't in love with her and that he was unprepared for the baby. His personal suspicions may have arisen due to the feelings of his mother, of course. What made it worse for him was that he was unable to attend any of the appointments at the clinic because of COVID. He had tried to call the clinics many times to get confirmation on the appointments and how the pregnancy was going, but due to patient confidentiality laws, even though he was the father, he could not be given any information. His only source of information was Taylor, who, for whatever reason, he lacked trust in. Finally, the golden month arrives, September, when, on the 22nd, the couple would finally get to meet their new addition. Family and friends of the couple had such little faith in Taylor that they were beginning to expect the news to break that she had suffered a miscarriage. Something strange yet interesting did happen later in the month, on the 15th to be exact. But it wasn't what the family and friends had been assuming. Tommy, Taylor's ex, contacted Wade on several occasions over a period of a few days via text message. He confirmed to Wade that Taylor had indeed had a hysterectomy and that the scan photos that she was presenting were from a previous pregnancy. Tommy also sent messages that he had sent to Wade to Taylor, who was furious. She dismissed the messages immediately, stating that Tommy was just trying to ruin her life. She insisted that she was pregnant and that the whole thing was a conspiracy. Taylor is now getting stressed, probably for one of two reasons. Firstly, she was pregnant and was being harassed by her ex. Her partner wasn't in love with her, and her potential in-laws saw her as a pathological liar, something that would upset any pregnant lady whose hormones were up and down like a drawbridge. Alternatively, she had told so many lies to so many people, either face-to-face or through email or social media, that they were now starting to catch up with her. If she had been lying, it is perfectly feasible that she may have gotten who she lied to, when she lied to them, and what the lie actually was, all jumbled up. In her hour of need, she turned to someone she called a friend, although in truth, she was more of an acquaintance. Her name was Reagan Michelle Hancock. The pair had met briefly when Taylor, who was working as a photographer, was hired by Reagan for her wedding day the year before. Taylor saw Reagan and her husband Homer as more than just customers because they gushed all over social media about how good the service that she provided had been. The pair maintained limited contact over Facebook, and Taylor knew that Reagan was pregnant with her second child. Taylor took a gift around to Reagan's house for her unborn baby. The two then exchanged text messages for the week following. On September 30th, 2020, remember, this is 8 days after the due date that Taylor had been telling everyone, she goes to a routine OB appointment at the clinic. But before the routine appointment can go ahead, she bursts into tears and starts screaming hysterically. When police arrive on site, the medical staff is trying their best to calm her down. She tells them that she could not go through with the appointment because her husband, who was in the military, has just died. Naturally, the staff have to take her at face value and agree that the appointment should be rescheduled. Medical staff even offered her a sonogram so that she could see her baby in hopes that it would make her feel slightly better, but Taylor declined the offer. One of the medical practitioners would later remark that it was odd to see Taylor go outside and sit on a bench for a considerable period of time, just watching pregnant women constantly coming and going from the clinic. On October the 5th, nearly a week after her OB appointment, there was still no sign of her baby. Perhaps a blessing in disguise, because Wade had become the victim of an arson attack at his home, destroying the plumbing and power supply. Fire investigators later concluded that the attack started using a lighter. Wade and Taylor were forced to go to Wade's parents' house to shower. While Wade was showering, Taylor told his mom that she was due to be induced that very day. But Taylor explained that her appointment had been canceled because of a bomb threat made against the medical center. I'm sure many of you are now thinking that there was, of course, no bomb threat at all. In fact, it was true. There was a bomb threat made against the medical center. Over 100 patients and staff had to be evacuated, and all medical procedures were canceled and rescheduled. Wade's mother, by this point, had had enough of Taylor, though. She did not believe a single word that came out of her mouth, and simply accused her of calling in the bomb threat herself. When it was Taylor's turn to shower, Wade's mom tried to convince him that Taylor was a liar and not pregnant. The mother and son got into a very heated argument. Wade had taken leave from work, expecting his child to come along at any moment. Wade's mom said that she was concerned if his work discovered that she wasn't actually pregnant, he could lose his job. Wade did not take kindly to his mother's interfering accusations, and as soon as Taylor finished in the shower, he stormed out of the house. Wade wasn't upset because he had fallen back in love with Taylor. He was furious because his family doubted the existence of his child and were seriously questioning his judgment. On the 8th of October, 2020, Taylor decided to go and see Reagan Hancock again. For some strange reason, she parked outside of the house for a while and just sat there. She didn't knock on the door. She drove off and came back a short time later with another baby gift and Starbucks coffee. The pair sat in the house chatting together before Taylor left at roughly 10 p.m. There was clearly no problem between the two. In fact, quite the opposite. Reagan posted on Facebook that evening, "So glad I got to see you. Missed you. Thank you for the sweet gift in Starbucks." The two had obviously had a nice evening, possibly comparing pregnancy notes and discussing the next day, the 9th of October, when Taylor's appointment to be induced had been rescheduled. One thing they couldn't have discussed, of course, was that the next day, Reagan would be dead. Cast your minds forward again. To recap, Taylor now sat in a hospital. Staff have discovered that she did not give birth that day. The poor child that she claims to have given birth to is in intensive care, critically ill and fighting for every breath. Poor Reagan Hancock has been found dead in her home and the police have been called. As if all of that wasn't enough, some other very strange events also happened on the morning of the 9th of October, 2020. Wade, who was so excited to be a father, why wasn't he driving Taylor to the hospital to be induced? Why was it only her and the baby in the car? The answer, believe it or not, lies with a trailer of hogs. Taylor had a week previous been contacted by a man called Scott, who had bought and sold livestock on his ranch in Oklahoma, roughly a four-hour drive from where Taylor and Wade lived. Taylor had tried to sell him 150 hogs for $6,100. The laws around buying and selling livestock are strict. You can't just turn up with animals and exchange them for money. You need licenses and invoices. Clearly, Taylor didn't know this, and the man thought it may have been a scam, so he rejected the offer. However, Wade received text messages from Scott telling him to be at his ranch between 6:30 and 7 a.m. on the 9th of October, and he would buy the hogs at an agreed price. The plan was for Wade to drive to the ranch, drop off the hogs, collect his money, and return in time for Taylor's afternoon appointment at the hospital. When Wade arrived at the ranch within the agreed time, having driven 150 hogs 4 hours, Scott didn't know what he was talking about. In fact, he became very frustrated with Wade because he had already declined the deal once before. Wade presented Scott with one of the text messages he said he received that said, quote, "Wade, it's Scott. I will see you both in the morning between 6:30 and 7. Taylor said the check would be made out to Wade Griffin. I have hunters coming this weekend. I need those hogs desperately." Scott was shocked at the messages Wade had showed him. They had not come from his phone number. When he saw Wade's surname, though, he put two and two together. He explained to Wade that he had spoken to a Taylor Griffin a week or so previous and had rejected the deal for the hogs. Scott returned to his ranch asking his ranch manager to show Wade out. Wade wasn't in a mood to drive these hogs back again. He asked Scott to reconsider a good deal, and the pair eventually agreed on $2,500. Wade didn't care about the price at this point. He just wanted to know what was going on and why Taylor had sent him there under a false pretense. Remember, Wade has absolutely no idea what's happening here. He must have been both confused and very distressed. As far as we know, Taylor was at home waiting for him to get back to take her to the hospital. But she wasn't. In fact, she had left the home that morning, went to fill up with gas, and headed to town for McDonald's. Meanwhile, Reagan was receiving some strange messages from a Google app number. Reagan, not knowing what the messages were about, didn't respond. But she received further messages at 7:49, which she did respond to. Immediately after she responded, her husband, Homer, started receiving some strange text messages of his own, allegedly from Reagan. Homer did not think they were the kind of messages that his wife would normally send. They just said things such as, "She just wants to be happy. This isn't working." Of course, concerned and probably worried about the messages he had received from his wife, Homer texted Reagan at 8:33 in the morning saying, "I love you." But Reagan did not text back. At 9:34, Homer received a Facebook message from a neighbor saying that their puppy had escaped from their home. He had tried to call Reagan to let her know, but she didn't answer. The neighbor also stated that their garage door was open. Alarm bells started to ring. Homer and Reagan never opened the garage door. He continued trying to call his wife at 9:58, 10:02, 10:04, 06, and 20 minutes after, and he still couldn't make contact. Homer began calling people close to them, and of course, Reagan's mom turned up at the house at roughly 10:15 that morning to be presented with the horrific, bloody scene of her daughter's murder. Meanwhile, across town, medical staff were still trying to work out what was going on with Taylor Parker. For whatever reason, Taylor had agreed to be examined by medical staff, externally and internally, with the discovery that the umbilical cord had never been connected to Taylor. Maybe she knew the game was up and there were no more lies left to tell. When medical staff examined her, they discovered that she did not have a cervix. All of the suspicions from Wade's family, the accusation from Taylor's ex, Tommy, had been true. She had, indeed, had a hysterectomy. Far from giving up, though, Taylor continued to tell the medical staff that she had given birth to the baby girl. She just wanted to make sure there were no mistakes. They even ran an ultrasound and tested for hormones that would be present had she been pregnant at all. All of the tests were negative. Taylor's lies were now about to start catching up with her. At 1 p.m. on the 9th of October, all of the police forces were notified of the murder of Reagan and the kidnap of the baby. Tragically, just 22 minutes after the call went out, the baby girl, courageously fighting for life in intensive care, was taken off life support and pronounced dead. Even more tragically, doctors said the baby would have had a good chance of surviving the ordeal she had been subjected to had she not suffered a severe lack of oxygen. Police immediately turned up at the hospital and arrested Taylor Parker for the capital murder of Reagan Hancock. A short time later, she was also charged with capital murder and the kidnap of baby Braxlyn Sage. When Taylor was interviewed by police, she admitted that she and Reagan had been involved in an argument in which she had shoved Reagan to the ground. The next part of the interview statement is something only a very disturbed person could have made up. She told police that after she shoved Reagan to the ground, Reagan said it felt like she was dying and that she had actually asked Taylor to take the baby so that she could save it. Taylor's words were, and I quote, "She begged me to take the baby. She said, 'Get her out of me, get her out of me.'" Taylor admitted that a knife found was in fact hers. She said it was a knife she had taken from a medical kit they used on their dogs after they had been hunting. Scenes of crime investigators also said that it was a scalpel that was used to cut Reagan open, but no scalpel had been found yet. Taylor said that she didn't take it with her and had left it on the ground. Investigators did eventually find the scalpel during the autopsy. It had been so repeatedly used that it had broken. Taylor had left it so deeply embedded inside Reagan's neck that officers couldn't see it. Police didn't buy any of the story, though. One officer told Taylor that he thought she was lying. He said that he believed that she had pushed the scalpel into the neck of Reagan before leaving the property with the intention of killing her. Taylor also told police that Reagan was the one who had invited her around that morning. Reagan was apparently aware of migraines and blackouts that Taylor had been allegedly suffering from. Taylor said on her way to the property that she had blacked out, waking up in her car in a parking lot. When she made it around to Reagan's home, she said Reagan grabbed her forcefully and told her to wake the F up. Taylor said that although she believed Reagan meant well, she scratched her. Taylor said that she tried to leave, but that Reagan wouldn't let her. And this is how the shoving started, which escalated into Taylor pushing her to the floor. Even to this day, police are unable to verify what Taylor and Reagan may have been discussing because Reagan's phone was never found. Police, of course, needed every detail and asked what happened when she removed the baby. Taylor said that she removed the baby from the amniotic sac and told Reagan that it wasn't breathing, to which Reagan replied, "Go!" Taylor, still seemingly living in her parallel delusional world, comforted by her never-ending fantasies and lies, tries to paint herself as some kind of savior to this child, almost a martyr-type figure who is now being persecuted by the law for trying to save a life. It is highly unlikely that Taylor's portrayal of the events hold any truth whatsoever. But according to the examination report from Reagan's body, she was still alive after the barbaric assault that she had been subjected to. Is there just a slim possibility that knowing she was dying, having had her baby cruelly and forcibly removed from the safety of her womb, that she could have actually told Taylor to get the baby medical help? If Reagan did do this, and that is a big if, it would mean that even with her last few breaths on Earth, her first thought was that of the life of her baby, Braxlyn Sage. An incredibly selfless act that would tie in with how people had described her personality, kind, caring, and as her sister said, the glue that held them all together. Maybe not so surprisingly for someone who, at best, is a fantasist and at worst a complete psychopath, Taylor decided to plead not guilty. She was held under a $5 million bail. Her trial lasted from mid-September of 2022 until the 3rd of October 2022. During the trial, much was exposed, not just with regards to her horrific crimes concerning Reagan and poor baby Braxlyn Sage, but also her life concerning Wade and the whole Griffin family. She admitted that she had lied about everything. All the money, being pregnant, buying the properties, everything was a sham. Remember the bomb threat at the hospital? Well, she lied about that too. Wade's mom was correct in her assumption that Taylor herself had called the threat in. It was revealed in court that she had downloaded an app to disguise her voice, making her sound like a man. How do you fake a pregnancy to such an extent that even your partner believes it? In Taylor's case, it was relatively simple. Her internet search history showed that she frequented a website called fakeababy.com. Yeah, for real. And had purchased fake pregnancy bellies. Her last purchase was just before she had the maternity photos taken with Wade. Throughout the trial, it was noted that Taylor was emotionless. She seemed to have no remorse for what she had done. Do you remember we mentioned that medical staff at the clinic she attended for her OB appointment thought it was odd that she didn't want an ultrasound to see her baby? She then sat outside watching pregnant women coming and going. Her search history on that day shows that she was doing more than just watching them. She was, in fact, searching for their car registration plates to try to find out where they lived. One can only thank God that she didn't succeed. Early on the morning of the 9th of October, before she went to Reagan's home to commit her horrific crime, and several days previous, she had been looking up C-sections on the internet, how they worked, and how a trained medical professional would conduct one at 34 weeks, the exact stage of pregnancy that Reagan Hancock was at. And what happened to Wade? We must remember and clarify that he knew absolutely nothing of the crimes and lies perpetrated by Taylor. He actually testified against her at the trial, saying that he believed her lies because she had shown him scanned pictures of their baby, the financial documents relating to millions of dollars which seemed to substantiate her claims, and more. Wade is no criminal. He is also a victim of Taylor Parker. However, he also was very naive to not question anything he was told by her. Taylor Parker's defense argued strongly that she couldn't face capital murder for Braxlyn Sage because the baby had not yet been born. They say a person cannot be charged for murdering a fetus. At best, a desperate tactic in a hopeless legal position. At worst, an extremely callous argument to make. However, the judge threw this out straight away. Poor baby Braxlyn Sage had been in fact born the minute she was prematurely brought into the world by the sick actions of Taylor. They also argued that Wade knew all along that she wasn't pregnant. They said that because he worked with livestock and had not only witnessed but participated in helping with the birth of hogs, he should have known that she wasn't really pregnant. The defense was really scraping the bottom of the barrel for arguments so hard that their fingers must have hurt. The judge again dismissed the argument, making it abundantly clear that Taylor Parker was the one on trial, not Wade Griffin. To make their impossible defense even harder, they were unable to find even one character witness for Taylor. When a defense can't even find one person to say one nice thing about their client, it speaks volumes about that person's personality. Taylor herself refused to take the stand. The defense managed a closing statement lasting a pitiful 8 minutes, while in contrast, the prosecution's lasted over 40. After less than 90 minutes of deliberation, the jury came back with the inevitable guilty verdict. Taylor didn't bat an eyelid. The judge in Bowie County had no hesitation in handing Taylor Parker the death penalty on the 10th of November of this year. The defense said that they did intend to appeal the sentence. The prosecution argued for the death penalty all the way through the trial, saying that Taylor would never change and was a risk to the population. Life will never be the same for the family of Reagan Hancock again. They lost a much-loved wife, daughter, sister, mother, and granddaughter. She was only 21 years old, her whole life in front of her, and expecting her second daughter very soon. She didn't do anything to anyone, least of all to a casual acquaintance like Taylor Parker, who she hardly knew. Reagan's mom, Jessica, described Taylor as an evil piece of flesh demon. She said in court, "My baby was still alive, fighting for her babies, when you tore her open and ripped her baby from her stomach." Taylor forced her way into Reagan's life. Not much, but enough to inflict a barbaric, unprovoked attack on her, then stealing her unborn baby. Reagan's 3-year-old daughter, Kinley, who was in the home at the time of the attack, will never see her mother again. Sadly, her biological father has also died, leaving her without a parent. However, Homer, being the good man that he is, has now adopted his stepdaughter and is bringing her up on his own. He is now in a new relationship, but does maintain contact with Reagan's family. He couldn't bring himself to go back to the home that he had shared with Reagan again and has now moved. He only went back one time to collect his possessions. The family of Reagan say they are pleased for Homer. Despite what happened, they believe that he deserves happiness. He is still in his 20s and is just as much of a victim as they all are. We know this case has been difficult to learn about. The crimes committed by Taylor Parker would have been unimaginable in any decent member of society. It is only right that we pay a special tribute to baby Braxlyn Sage. When she was kidnapped, she weighed just 7 pounds and was only 18 inches long. She had no idea what was going on when she was forcibly removed from her mother. She was never given a chance to experience life, to grow up, go to school, and have fun. We can only hope that while she left this world extremely prematurely, that God took her off to an eternal paradise. Hopefully she can live in peace, reunited with her mother. Rest in peace, little one. We at Beyond Evil bring you these horrific true crime stories to highlight what some people are capable of. The victims of these crimes are always our main concern. It is almost beyond comprehension when we see the lengths that people such as Taylor Parker will go to hurt another human being. The death penalty has always been a subject that divides public opinion. Some argue for its use, some against it. One thing that we think everyone will agree on is that Taylor Parker should never be allowed out of prison where law-abiding citizens could be at the mercy of her unhinged mind again. We dedicate this documentary to all of those hurt by the actions of one evil woman, to the memories of Reagan Michelle Simmons Hancock and to baby Braxlyn Sage Simmons Hancock. May they both rest in eternal peace. If you found this story compelling, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen and leave a 5-star review if you would like to show your support. And don't forget to hit the notification bell to stay up to date each time we reveal a new shocking case. Until next time, stay safe and keep your eyes peeled. You never know what's lurking in the shadows.